Okay, good afternoon. Chalk. My lone piece of chalk. So, in thinking about what happened on Monday, I realized I don't think I really explained databases to you, did I? Have I really talked about tables and indices and things like... I was sure I had done that. I think I was remembering last semester. So, there's a few things I want to explain about that. Let me put up a vocabulary list here. Let me make sure I describe these. So, okay, so I've got a bunch of things here. Table, relation, index, primary key, secondary key, query, schema, insert, update, delete, for row, column, and tables, and MongoDB, document ID, and collections. So, let me try to explain the relationships among these. So, first off, are any of these terms kind of familiar? Do you feel like you know some of these already? Or is this all kind of... So which of you kind of feel like when you look at these terms, you kind of go, like, I kind of know what these are? Okay. You've had databases? Yeah.
Words are familiar, I'm just not sure if I know the right definition for this context.
Okay.
I kind of recognize them from tutorials and stuff.
Right, from the tutorials, we talked about some, but... But yeah, if you haven't had a course in databases, this stuff... Or you haven't played with databases. This might be a little confusing. Sometimes I kind of forget this because a lot of this database stuff I really learned on my own a long time ago, and it always seemed kind of intuitive. It's like, well, not necessarily. So first off, let's talk about, you want to store, I'm going to work through an example, and then we'll talk about how these terms apply to it. So let's first say I want to store people's addresses. People's addresses and contact information. So I want to store their, let's say their name. I want to store their address. You know, so let's say I also want to store their phone and email. We'll just say it's four things. To simplify things. Of course, you could break down the address into multiple components, multiple phone numbers, have multiple email addresses, name, first, last name. Let's do it a little simplified here. So I want to store this. If I want to store it in a database, the classic relational database, what you would do is you would create a table to store these things. And this table, there would be columns or fields. Here we have name, address, phone, email. Notice it starts looking kind of spreadsheet-like, and spreadsheets can be thought of as databases, but as data tables, but and you can, and there are in fact been spreadsheets that have had sort of database-like operations, but
database storage medium spreadsheets are more of a math medium.
Well, yeah, but it's an interface modality, and you can blend the two in various ways. I'm just sort of acknowledging that similarity. We won't talk about it just yet. So now, if I want to have someone's name in here, I'll say Anil. I'll say Ottawa. 555 something. I'll say Soma. So I'm just filling in the columns. So this is. These are fields for columns, and these are the rows or records. Notice each row would correspond to a specific individual. And I could just have a bunch of names here, and they'd all have their addresses. And so if this was, so of course associated with each of these might be a type. Right now these are all basically strings, but you could have certain fields that were numeric. Maybe some of the fields were dates or the things. You can constrain these in other ways, but let's just say we've got strings here. Now, let's say we have this. An obvious thing I'd want to do, operation you can do is just give me all the records. And so he said, okay, dump me all the records. And you could format this in some way, maybe turn it, produce a report that would have each name followed by an address, followed by the phone numbers, followed by, or maybe just the name of the address, say, to make mailing labels. This is something I did when I was a kid. Build up a database and then print mailing labels. You don't really print mailing labels quite so often, but you get the idea. But a lot of times with the database, you won't necessarily want to dump everything. You'll only want to access certain parts of it. You'll say, I want all of the people who live in Ottawa. Or I want everyone who has a phone number with a prefix of 523. Or I want everyone's name who begins with an M. So these are various criteria. So when I formulate those sort of questions in a precise language, that's a query. You guys do queries all the time nowadays when you go to Google and type in a search. And that's all we're saying here is having a query. But of course, Google by default supports mainly keyword searches. But you could do with here, the data is structured. So keyword searches make sense on documents that have no structure. You're just looking for occurrences of things. In a database, you have structure. So if you're looking for a name, it doesn't make sense to look for the name in the address. So if you just say, search for Anil anywhere in the database, that's not normally what you do with a structured database. You say, Anil in the name field. So you make queries like, I want, all records where Anil is the name. Now, you all are CS people, so you can think of this sort of rule, specify the number of languages. When people talk about SQL, SQL is structured query language. It's just a precise way of articulating things like this.
Yes. So, essentially, when querying the database, you search one column at a time, essentially?
Well, I haven't told how this happens. And that the next, I'm just saying that I am specifying constraints that say, I want to talk about a subset of records that meets certain criteria. That criteria is known as a query, and languages in which I can specify, these things are query languages, and SQL is the most popular of these, structured query language. But it's just one. And in fact, MongoDB doesn't support SQL. More generally, it supports things like JavaScript to do queries. But again, all we're doing now is we're specifying a constraint on this. Now, how would you code something like this if this was just kind of a simple, let's say you encoded this in your application where every record was an object, and you stored this as an array of objects. If you stored this as an array of objects where each object would be, you know, have a property of name is an ill, address is a, you know, address is a property, phone number, email, you know, you could see writing a program that would allow you to search for the objects that match this criteria. And the standard way you would do this is through a for loop. Right? You do a for loop through the array, you would examine each of them, say, does this object meet these conditions? Yes. Okay, add it to my results. Otherwise, continue on. Databases are designed to do these kinds of things efficiently. So the question is, how do you make this efficient? Well, first off, let's assume our queries are restricted. Let's assume I don't ever want to search, I don't ever want to specify things by the address or by the phone number or by the email. I only ever want to search for things using the name. If I want to search only using the name, how do I organize this?
Alphabetically.
Sort it. Right? If you only want to do searches, you just have to sort it. Well, at least, now, of course, that won't necessarily support subsets of names, but that would accelerate anything if I'm looking for a name that starts with a certain string. If I sort them by the name, so I just store all of these in the order of name, then I can do that query fast. Now let's say, well, I want to do searches that are fast on the name and on the email. I want to search for things that start with a certain, you know, prefix of a name and start with a certain prefix of an email address. Well, one way to do it is when I do queries for one, I sort it there, you know, sort for it, and if I want to do queries for another, I'll sort it for the other one. But let's assume this data structure is big. If it's big, if it's so big it doesn't even fit in memory or something, sorting it is expensive. That involves reading all the data and writing it all back out. So databases are optimized so that you don't have to... They're optimized so that, in general, you never move things around on disk. Once you've written a disk, you're not going to read it up and copy it and change the structure of things. Changing the structure of a database is painful. It's expensive. It's dangerous. You don't do it. So you're going to have an order... And also, if you just sort it by one of these fields, it's also a little problematic, because what if two people have the same name? Now you might start thinking that they're duplicating and start checking. So one of the basic ways, so query optimization, how to make some kinds of queries fast or whatever, you can think of this as an arbitrarily complex problem. Because your data can have arbitrary structure, your queries can have arbitrary structure. To do this in the full, I mean, this is what you study in database theory, and it's not an easy problem. But the basic strategy is pretty simple. You pre-compute things. You organize the data in some way so as to make certain kinds of criteria quick, you know, fast. And the way you organize your data is using indices. All an index is a way of assigning an arbitrary ordering to your records based on some criteria. The easiest way to do indices is I want an index so that I can, so that's sorted on name, maybe an index that's sorted on the phone numbers, an index that's sorted on emails, and then I can do searches for those rather quickly. So instead of, so that I'm saying functionally what an index allows you to do, it allows you to, an index is based on a certain field, and whatever field it's based on, you can now do fast searches on it because it is sorted by that field. Now, an index can be an arbitrary function of the data in your things, but that's the simplest one. So we can have, so let's say we have an index on, so what would the index on name look like? So we'd sort by name, so we have. So we'd have the names. And then we'd have another index for phone numbers. And that would have the phone. But now I will tell you in an index, you always have two parts. One is the thing you're sorting by, and the other is something that allows you to get to the record fast. It's a pointer to the record. Now you might go like, well, how do I have a pointer to the record? How do I do that fast? Depends on the structure. Depends on how it's organized. But in general, with most databases, you add in an ID field of some kind. And this ID field is your, is known as the primary key. This is the key that determines the ordering in your database, and more importantly, determines how you uniquely refer to each record. Every record in your database must have a unique ID. That's how they're distinguished from each other. Two people can have the same name, but they will both have the same, you know, have distinct IDs. The reason why companies and organizations always want things like your social insurance number is because those are generally considered to be unique for citizens of a given nation. So they can serve as very nice IDs of records. As we'll talk about, that is a very useful property. But, so all you do is you have this, and then you have the ID. And so you not only do you have this maybe sorted by ID, but maybe you set up an associative hash for this or whatever, but you make it so that you can access any record by its ID very quickly. How exactly you do that is internal to the database, you don't necessarily care. Easiest way is to sort it, but you can also do things with hashes and whatever. These fields that you set up these other indices for are known as secondary keys. A secondary key is a field that you have an index for. There is no requirement on uniqueness for secondary keys. There's only a requirement for uniqueness on the primary key. There is a primary key for a table, and there can be multiple secondary keys. So you might naturally say, well, if I want to optimize queries, why don't I index on every field? Why don't I make every one of these a secondary, you know, secondary key?
Wouldn't that slow down, like, writing to the database? Because every time you add a record, you'd have to, like, go through and update the indices?
Exactly. That's exactly it. If you, the more indices you, well, think of, there's first of all a space overhead. These take, I mean, this grows with the size of your database, each index. If you have one for each field, that means, you know, you're increasing that by, you know, whatever constant factor. You have to now pay the cost to update that index on every change to the database.
because you want your index to be up to date, otherwise the query's up there. I mean, another way you can do it is you say you don't update your indices on every time, but that means you can't do up-to-date queries. And say, oh, well, periodically we'll rebuild the index or something, but most of the time you build, you update the indices on the fly. Well, you'd like to, because then you always have, you know, queries of the current data. Yes?
Just going to mention, updating sorted data structures is generally more expensive because where it's inserted is important. Also,
well, it depends on the nature of it. Like, if, for example, if this is a linked list, you know, it's not very hard. I mean, well, a linked list is
it's painful to traverse.
Yeah, you have the traversal. But like, for example, if you have an array, well. I want to talk about the data structure you'd use for doing this. This is the nice thing about something like a database, is that other people have taken the trouble to choose the data structures so as to make these operations fast. And part of choosing the right type of database is to know what sort of structures here. So I'm not talking about how you organize these records, how you organize indices. This is all other complexity. Which is very interesting, but that's not our property here. We're users of database in this class.
This year around, you essentially have to run through resources of the entire database instead of just one field.
Right. But no, when done properly, you can keep these indices up to date with incremental cost. It's not horribly expensive, but it does increases your space constraint. Your consumption, and it does increase the cost of insertions and updates, and you pay that. So in general, you do not index on everything. And remember, just because you make an index on a given field, that's not necessarily the only kinds of indices you might want to do. Really, an index is something designed to accelerate queries. So it's whatever criterion you might want to have in there. So it might be a function of the data in here. Like, for example, if you just sort the email addresses, that won't necessarily help you quickly find all the email addresses that are from Google, because it's by your username at Google. You have to create a separate index that is sorted by the domain name of the email addresses. And that would accelerate the queries for the domain name of the email address. So building indices is and optimizes is all about what kind of queries you want to do. And you can't optimize for all possible queries. You have to make choices. So this is the basic structure of a table. In a relational database, we don't have one table. We have multiple tables that are related to each other. Simplest way I can see this is think of this as this contact list. Think of this as a customer database. This is your customer table. And then let's go over here and let's say we want I want to have invoices. So in this invoice table, I'm going to have an ID. I might have the items sold. Now, of course, when you start thinking about this, you realize that doing an invoice table is actually generally more complicated because you probably have to make this of multiple tables because how do you allow for multiple items to be sold? But let's assume that this is an invoice where only one item is sold per invoice. So let's say item sold, price, and then I'd like to know who I sold it to. So then I'd want customer ID. That's the simplest kind of invoice you have. You have the the item sold, its description, how much it cost, and then who I sold it to. I could put all of these fields directly in here. But then, how do I know if one customer is my best customer? Because they buy all kinds of items from me. This way, I could just know, oh, well, they're all the same customer ID. I just sort this by, you know, I do index by customer ID here, and I know who's been buying all my stuff. But you notice here, this is a pointer, this is a reference to this table. That's a relation. So relational databases, you're just having multiple data structures that are interconnected. You might ask, well, what if I have a customer ID that doesn't have a corresponding customer? What you should say is, my database is corrupted. Because there should never be the case where you have an invoice with a customer ID for which you do not have an appropriate customer record. But notice this customer ID here is the unique ID here. I don't put the name here because the name may not be unique. I put the ID here because that uniquely refers to a record. That's this basic database design. Because you want your pointers to point uniquely. So in a relational database engine, not only can you do queries against one table, you do queries that can involve multiple tables. That's questions about saying, you know, you can ask questions like, give me the customer that has, you know, that has spent the most money with us. And so in order to do that, they would do the query on the invoice table and then come over here and pull that person's name from this table. Say, okay, John Smith, they're our best customer. So hopefully this kind of, I mean, you've all dealt with linked data structures. You've all learned this stuff. That's all we're talking about here. It's just that instead of pointers, we talk about these primary keys and references those primary keys. But that's all. Now the problem with classic relational databases is that you basically pre-decide what all the fields are, what all the columns are. And adding new columns is a very expensive operation. But of course, if you're talking about other kinds of data structures with typical in-memory things, adding a new property to an object is a really easy operation. So if you're doing something like MongoDB, you don't have these constraints. So how does MongoDB look like this? Well, instead of a record, instead have a document. Instead of a table, you have a collection. But by default, MongoDB does not implement any notion of relations. Its query language that it gives you is very simple. But it does give you the capacity of creating indices. But if you think about this for a second, wait, if my documents can have arbitrary properties and I can change which properties they have, how do I know that they all have a primary key? The MongoDB solution is MongoDB maintains its own primary key for your documents. There is an underscore ID field. This is what's maintained for every document in a collection. Every document gets inserted this underscore ID property, and that is what uniquely identifies each document. And MongoDB maintains these. There's auto-generated. So you aren't responsible for maintaining the primary key. It's just some arbitrary internal thing that it produces for you, which is a difference from traditional relational databases. And so, but you now say, I want this other property to be a secondary key? you can tell MongoDB to generate an index on any other property. But the only reason to do that is to accelerate query operations. Because, again, the find one kind of operation, that's a query. But that's a very fixed kind of query. It's not a general language for asking arbitrary questions. It's saying, I want to find all of the documents that meet this exact criterion. It does have a query language, but it's rather simplified. So, but if you specify a query that doesn't have a particular index, or it will just do it the long way. It will just do a linear search through all the records to find it. Now, in the case of our thing here, you're going to have very small collections. That linear search, who cares? So this is not how you do it in production, but for the purpose of this, I'm not expecting you to generate any indices to any sort of query optimization. Just have it do it. You won't even notice the execution time unless you start generating hundreds of thousands of rooms or something. And it's like, I don't think you have the time for that. So, if you want to, fine. You know, it's a couple of extra lines. You just tell MongoDB, you know, to make this, build an index on this one, and it takes care of it, and you don't think about it. But it's an extra step for which, for the purposes of this class, you won't ever see the difference. So I've talked about indices, queries. Oh, so relations table. Okay, I talk about operations, and I need to talk about schemas. So we talk about a database. Oh, sorry, yes.
For the table is collections in MongoDB.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure what you meant by table. As in table for.
This is the table.
For
this is the table. When I say rows and columns,
okay.
This is a table. And this one would be another table. This invoices with all the individual invoices being the rows, and the columns being the ID, item sold.
Then you have which part of it is the fields?
Field is a column.
Which is not a document or a collection.
That's a property. So when you have objects, and objects have properties, right? A document, to a first approximation in MongoDB, is an object. This is basically an object. Really, MongoDB serves as a very nice kind of JSON store. Just stores JavaScript objects and JSON notation. It actually stores in what's known as BSON, which is a binary format JSON. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. So what I was saying is schema. So when people talk about a database schema, what they're talking about is the organization of the database in terms of what is the structure of each table and what are their relationships. That's the entire database schema, because there may be many tables, many relations between them. You have to, when you say with the database schema, that's what you're talking about. Then we're talking about these operations. So we'll talk in MongoDB terms. If you're going to insert a document, what you're telling MongoDB is, I want to create a new document with a new unique identifier, a unique ID, which it will determine for you. And then it will be, otherwise the properties of it will be the same as the properties in the object you give it. Delete, you're normally saying you're deleting, you want to say delete an object, so I'm deleting a document. So MongoDB supports the deletion of documents very simply. You say, okay, here's a document with this unique identifier, get rid of it. And then it'll be gone. Now, to delete a table, that's basically deleting a collection. In general, you don't want to do that, but it does support that. Deleting a row, these are the same things. Because if you delete a row, that's just a record, which is a document. Now, what does it mean to delete a column in MongoDB? In general, that's not possible as one step in MongoDB.
because each document is independent. That's not how it's organized. The way you do it is by going through each document and removing that property. Which again is a difference from classic relational databases. Although I'm not sure if it might have an accelerator operation to do that. I haven't looked into that. But MongoDB is not really organized around the notion of a column, so the notion of deleting a column is kind of bizarre. Update. So notice the difference between update and insert is insert generates a new document ID, and then you're adding the contents. With update, you specify the document ID, and you tell it what should go in it. And you either do this destructively so it erases everything that was there before, or you update it incrementally, you just update certain properties of it. So the basic process of using MongoDB is if you're wanting to update a document, you have to first find it, because you have to get its unique identifier. You then have a JSON object. You have to manipulate the JSON object to be whatever you want, and then you tell it to update it. If you're creating something completely new, you just create a JSON object, and then you tell it to insert, and when you insert it, it will get its own unique identifier. Now, there might be another document that has exactly the same contents as the one you just inserted. It's up to you to check for duplicates, because MongoDB will happily say, oh, it's a new one, that's fine, because it has a new unique identifier which it just generated.
Insert, you can insert a property to a unique identifier anytime.
You insert a property to a document.
Property.
A
yes.
New property to a document anytime. Yes. Basically, what well so
then how is it?
So I'm talking about insert document to a collection.
Then how is it that you can't which would correspond to a new column in the table?
So the difference is, so you don't normally insert a property. You update a document. You say, I have an existing, you have an existing document. You get that existing document by some query. So now you know what its unique identifier is. You now have it in the form of an object. You now make changes to it, including adding a property, whatever. And then you update MongoDB store saying, here is a new here it is, go replace it. And one of the properties is this unique ID, and then MongoDB says, oh, I'll look for the one that has this unique ID and I'll replace it with this. It doesn't really keep track of which documents have which properties. Except when you have an index, but the index can basically just say, oh, that document doesn't have that property, so it's not your index.
So not all the same.
They don't all follow. So when you're using something like Mongoose, the point of using Mongoose rather than the standard MongoDB things is that it enforces a schema. So here, when we say schema, it means that every document will have certain properties. We're basically making MongoDB look more like this. The Undying Engine doesn't enforce this, but we're enforcing this at the application level. So does this make it clearer with what I want you to do for the assignment? So some bits of it seem unclear. I mean, you have to look up the specific API calls. I'm going to give you example code on Friday, which will do things. But you already have two bits of code that do things with MongoDB.
If you just maybe make it clear that the collection is a set of key value.
Okay, what you're talking about is a key value store. MongoDB is not a key value store. So a key value store is a specialized kind of database. And if you look them up and stuff, but a key value store is a simplified version of this. It just basically says you have IDs and one property. It's a key and one value. So, like for example, here we would just say
Now, of course, what that value is, it could be complex. But a key value store is normally used where you just have a specific element. It's basically an associative array, writ big. It's a persistent associative array. That's all a key value store is. Now, maybe you have you start having multiple keys and other things like that, then you start getting to these more database things. But a simple key value store allows you to set up a bunch of associative arrays that are persistent. And the nice thing about doing those sort of things is they can be very fast, very scalable. And if that's all you need, that's great. But a lot of times that isn't what you need. So if you're looking up at the NoSQL type databases, you have to look at what they're doing. Are they document stores? Are they key value stores? It all depends on what kind of data you want to store in them and what kind of queries you want to facilitate. What kind of update operations? Yes.
Back to the Mongoose, so all of the objects have the same properties. Would that make deleting columns faster, or like how would we go about deleting columns?
The only way you delete a column normally is by going through and editing each object and deleting it.
So there's no one template that you can edit?
Exactly. That's the big difference.
Okay.
Now, of course, in something like MongoDB, you would, why not just ignore it? I mean, instead of going through and updating it in something like MongoDB, what you do is, if there's a field that you no longer need, there's a property you no longer need, then you just make your code so that if you ever see that field, discard it and don't write it back. You know, no need to explicitly, you just ignore it. Why bother rewriting your entire database? It's a value to ignore.
So there's, relational databases, object stores, key value stores.
Oh, transactions. So what's a transaction in this model? It's actually pretty simple. I want to change more than one table at the same time, atomically. Which means I want to update the... So let's say, for example, I add another field here that is, the total sold. I want to keep track for these customers how much they've ever spent on me. This is a function of the sum of all the invoices. So whenever I make changes to the invoices, I have to also change the customer database. But if for some reason I update this total and I don't add an invoice. Let's say I insert invoice, but then something that messes up. I now can have these two tables be inconsistent. So the whole notion of transaction is that both get updated or neither updated get updated. You can never do a partial update where I update the total for a customer here and I don't update the invoice. Or I update the invoice and I don't update the total here. I want to join those together. When I make it something atomic, it means I can't break it apart. That's all an atomic operation is. So I want to make this atomic, and the whole way you make a transaction atomic is about you do this, you do that, you check to make sure everything's okay, and only then do you commit it. So that means you make a tentative change to one table, you make a tentative change to the other table, and then you check to make sure all the changes went through, and then you say, okay, finalize them. They're all good. And it's only considered part of the database once it's been finalized. And if it never gets finalized, you don't consider it part of the database and you undo it. MongoDB does not support transactions. If you want transactions, that's what relational databases are for. That's what SQL, all that technology, so they're talking about the common things, Oracle databases, MySQL sort of, PostgreSQL definitely. That's what things that support transactions, they're talking about updating multiple tables at this, you know, in a way such that you can never do partial updates. So you can see if you have a lot of different tables and they have lots of complex relationships, making sure everything happens as a transaction is very important for data integrity. And if you don't use transactions, you get all kinds of inconsistent data. Remember earlier when I talked about airlines, airline reservations? One of these tables represents the seats available in a given flight, and another one, you know, says how much is a customer paid and stuff. You don't update these things together, and they sort of get split. You get things that some customers have paid and they never got a seat, or someone gets a seat and they never paid for it. And inconsistent data structures, very bad. In web applications, oftentimes, though, you do not need to enforce transactions because actually you aren't dealing with multiple tables. You're often maybe only dealing with, you know, one collection. That's all you need. And in those situations, you don't need to do this. Or if you do require some transactional logic, it's relatively simple, and you can implement it yourself in your own program. Updates to documents in MongoDB are atomic. When you say, here is an update for a document, and you give it an object, all of that object will be committed to the database, or none of it will be. You won't get a record where half the properties are updated and half of them aren't. That's a guarantee that MongoDB does. But its atomic operation is at the level of documents. So inserts, you know, or updates succeed or fail, they don't do something in the middle.
Your program, say, you write your own transaction for MongoDB.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any for, like, I don't know.
Basically, if you're, I'll step back. If you find yourself trying to really implement transactions in MongoDB, stop using MongoDB. That's basically what I'd say. It's not to say you can't implement it, but you're probably going to implement it in a buggy way. And the trouble with things like transactions is that a buggy implementation is worse than no implementation because it will fail in really weird corner cases that you won't know until you get to production, and then people will curse your name. So if you need transactions, use the tool that supports transactions. The cost is transactions add overhead, runtime overhead. So if you don't need transactions, it's good to go with a system that doesn't support them. Now, some people would say applications change over time, and you may think that you don't need this functionality now. Like, you think you don't need complex queries, you think you don't need transactions, but as your application evolves, it will need them down the future, and by choosing this technology that doesn't support it, you're shooting yourself in the foot. And most of the time, and the performance benefits you get from doing this are minimal. Possible. But in general, SQL-type, transaction-type databases require a lot of synchronization among their state, so they tend to be less scalable. Remember all the stuff we talked about scalability? They're just inherently stuff because they're harder to do because you have to do these atomic transactions, which requires lots of coordination, and do that coordination reliably takes time. In practice, you rarely are developing an application from scratch. You're probably building on someone else's, and they probably already made this decision. So you can decide whether they made the decision or not. But if you're going from scratch, you may want to just say, go with a full database if you can afford it, and then switch to these other forms if you find it doesn't go fast enough. But if you do that, then you'll find that, oh no, I've got all these complex things. I have to completely re-architect my application in order to support more flexible, in order to support the limitations of this other store, and now I'm in pain. Trade-off. It's the reason you get paid the big bucks when you go out there in the real world. So I'm already at 325 here. So I can pause here for a second, or I can just kind of go on. When I pause for a second, I want to think about your questions, and then we'll just wrap up.
Okay, let's go ahead and let's go ahead and continue here. So with a database like MongoDB, when you're doing queries, the classic way you do the kind of queries is through document exemplars. So you could think of a document exemplar as just a document that's partially filled in. And you want to find other documents that are like it. And the simplest kind of exemplar is a document with just one field filled in. So the name equals to this, and then it pulls up all the documents that match, that have that field equal to this. But you could have other fields there, and you can put in simple kind of relationships into those fields. So it's not just are they exactly equal, but you could say it's a prefix, you could say it's greater than, you can do some of these other things, but basically it's all based on giving a exemplar document and saying find things that look like this document. So that's, notice that's MySQL has a whole language for describing this. I find MongoDB is, it's kind of a little more intuitive. It just makes it look like this document. And how, and your query languages and how you specify the wildcards there. So I wasn't really planning on saying much more about MongoDB and databases. I mean, there are entire classes to talk about this. The main thing I wanted here in the context of this class was you'd understand why you'd want to use a database. I think we talked about that more and the basic kind of operations you do with it. Here, what we're using functionally databases for is just as a persistent store of JavaScript objects. And that's all you should potentially need it for. Yes?
What's a schema?
The schema is the design of a database. It's the structure of it. You can talk about schemas in reference to specific tables, or in a full relational database, you want to talk about the database schema, you're talking about how all the tables connect. So in MongoDB, it's often referred to as being schemaless, because we don't enforce any restrictions upon particular documents. Some of them can have certain properties, other ones won't have them. The only thing that MongoDB does enforce is that every document has to have a unique identifier. And MongoDB maintains the identifier space.
But like in Mongoose, like in the example that we had there before where it was, dot schema, is that like when...
Well, the idea is that Mongoose gives you a way of imposing a schema. So with Mongoose, you treat MongoDB like it was a table. It's a little bit more flexibility, but that's basically what Mongoose is doing, saying, I want to use MongoDB, but I really want something that's more table-like. I want to make sure every document all have the same properties. And so you specify a schema. And then Mongoose makes sure every document has every...
So Mongoose and MongoDB are...
Mongoose is an abstraction... Mongoose is an abstraction layer on top of MongoDB. So when you use the other MongoDB drivers, you're doing more raw access to MongoDB. When you use Mongoose, it's an abstraction on top of it.
Does that mean the properties of whatever object is originally initialized, or can it be nothing? Since not all objects?
Mongoose, I believe, can specify defaults. Okay. I think you can specify defaults. But with MongoDB, if a property is not there, it's just like an arbitrary JavaScript object. What if you don't define a property? It's undefined. It always has a value. The value is undefined. Which is, I don't know, it seems like a joke or something. But it's undefined. Anything else about databases? You feeling? So one side note is, if you're using a database, does the database always have to be outside of your application? Or can it be embedded inside of your application? Have you heard of something called SQLite? Have any of you heard of this? Mm-hmm. So SQLite,
So if you're build, you want some sort of database-like functionality in your application. One way to do this is by setting up a full-fledged database server that you're going to connect to. It's a separate process. Now you've got a MySQL thing you have to set it up in. But you might say, I don't actually have that much database, much data to store. I don't really need something that big. I want something that's just in my application. But I would like something that supports more complex queries. So SQLite is an embeddable database. It's very liberally licensed, and it's embedded everywhere. So if you're looking for a database to put into like a C or C++ application, I'm pretty sure it can be integrated into Node directly. I haven't looked into it, but I recall seeing SQLite interfaces for it. You can do it. And the nice thing about SQLite is it actually supports most of the relational database stuff that you might want. It's rather full-featured. It's just small. Now, of course, that means it's not particularly scalable. It's not necessarily particularly persistent. It doesn't necessarily guarantee everything writes to disk and stuff like that. I mean, but for something for storing data structures and things, it can be very nice. So you look at major browsers and stuff, when they store your preferences or other things like that, they often do it through a little SQLite database. You see little .db files there in the profiles of various applications. Oftentimes they're SQLite. So you don't have, it isn't just for really big things. You can also use it in other applications. And in fact, what you can do is if you use something like SQLite and you find out you run against its limits, then you can move, the interface will be the same and you move to something else. So you might notice that I'm not being particularly committal in whether I'm saying you should use a full SQL-based transaction-supporting database, or you should use something like a key-value store, or you should use something like a document store, which is MongoDB. And that's true, because it depends. The only reason I chose MongoDB really for this class is because I didn't want to deal with the complexity of teaching you SQL when it wasn't necessary for the purposes here, and we could do all the functionality without it. If you want to start programming MongoDB, it has a built-in JavaScript engine. So you can start coding queries and everything, code that will run on the database in JavaScript. JavaScript everywhere. Not that we're really going to use that functionality. Also, it's optimized for storing things that look like JSON objects. So it's useful for the purposes of this class. If you go out in the real world and say everyone should build your stuff like this, don't associate my name with that. Because that's not what I'm telling you. But this is what I want to take. So the role of Mongoose, I really didn't make that clear, but Mongoose versus the MongoDB drivers, now that's clear and stuff. I'm going to move on from databases here and plan on not talking about them anymore. So now I'm going to erase everything and spend the last 15 minutes or so
talking about what
other web application development environments. Starting with some old ones. So, you all remember I don't know how many of you have probably, this is probably before most of your time, but what was the first programming language for the server side for writing web applications? Anyone know what the first programming language was that people really used commonly? They kind of used C for a little bit, but.
CGI?
CGI is what I'm talking about, yes. But what language was used for CGI? Come on.
Pearl.
Does anyone here still use Perl? What do you use it for?
I use it mostly for automated software testing.
Yep.
With machine language.
It's really funny how some programming languages prosper for a while and then become amazingly unfashionable. Perl is one of those languages. It's got a lot of nice things about it, but Perl is just not favored much at all. But for a while, it was the language to know. And its use really came in with the web. So, okay.
So CGI, common gateway interface.
Remember, originally web servers were about serving files. So you had a static file on disk, and that's what you'd send to the client when it asked for it. CGI was an evolution of this, so saying, I don't want to send a file, I instead want to do something more dynamic. So a file got mapped to a Perl script. So every time a particular page was requested, the web server would say, oh, you want that page? Well, that refers to a particular Perl script, so I will run the Perl script. And the command line arguments say that typically the Perl script would be for handling a form. So every time the web server would get a post for a particular page, it would run a Perl script and give it as its arguments or its environment variables. So the CGI interface basically gave a standardized way. I forget even now how exactly it works. I'll look that up. But it would give you a standard way of passing all the parameters that would come from the web request to the script. So now this comes a way of calling a program saying, okay, this program, here I want you to handle this post request. Here are all the properties of the post request. Here's the body. Go. And when you return, give me back a web page. And that web page I will then send off. So that was originally how you did that, did programming. Why is this a bad idea now? Why don't we do this anymore? Seems a pretty simple thing. You just run a program, it just runs once, and then just gives you a program. You can write it in any programming language. And you can use it to handle requests pretty simply. What's wrong with this? From our perspective. Come on. I just.
Only executable on command. Each command is an entire different process.
So that means I'm running a whole binary for every incoming web request. I'm starting up a new process, bringing it up, giving it the stuff, and then once it's done, it kills that process. That's expensive. That is not scalable for a web server that's going to handle lots and lots of requests. When this was an occasional thing, okay. The other thing is, again, that process isolation. How do you share state amongst all your running scripts? The only way to really share state is to have it somewhere else, i.e. in a database. So initially, Perl scripts were what you used for talking to a back-end database. You'd have Perl, and you'd have a back-end database, and the Perl would talk to the MySQL database, and it would store things, and that's how you coordinate them. The server itself would have no state. It'd all be in the database. But you have now there were then standards come up like fast CGI. And the idea of fast CGI is you don't start up an entire process every time. You actually keep it running. And it can take multiple queries. You know anything that uses fast CGI now? That's used still very commonly? Well, that's one way of using it, at least. PHP. When people talk about PHP, it's really in the same model. The execution model was updated to some degree to make it so that the web server interfaces better with it. But it's all about you run a script, you get an incoming request, the web server runs a script using some sort of interpretation engine, and it sends it back. This might seem kind of weird now because you've been doing it the node style. But the node style says, why am I bothering with this whole other thing when all it's doing is serving files? And most of the time I'm not serving files, I'm actually running code. Why don't I just put that into my main loop? That's when you get something like node. When you look at PHP applications, though, their architecture is still around run a script for each incoming request. And the coordination between the scripts is kind of ad hoc. It's not to say you can't create rather sophisticated applications. There's some very sophisticated PHP applications. But that's the architecture.
What other languages, environments are used to create web applications? What other technology have you heard of?
Ruby.
Ruby was a cool language, best when it was just Ruby. I remember back in grad school, I had another grad student just loved Ruby. He said that was the thing he liked to write stuff in. I remember it just being this kind of, isn't that the documentation in Japanese? Why do you want to use that? Okay, I can see it's better than Perl, but it still looks kind of like Perl. And why do you want to use Ruby? So what changed was Rails. That's what has really made Ruby popular, is an application framework for making web applications called Rails. Has anyone programmed in Rails? So the thing, before you can understand Rails, what you have to understand is what came before. So part of what came before is PHP and Perl. But the other things that came before are things like Java. And in particular, when I say Java, I'm talking Java and Microsoft's ASP. And JSP, I'm talking about Java server pages, active server pages. These were frameworks for writing web applications, where they said, okay, we don't want to do things with Perl. Well, Perl's not our language. We don't like it. It's got lots of messiness. Perl had this idea of saying, there's more than one way to do it. And for most programmers, the idea of more than one way to do one thing is a recipe for chaos. So, one issue with Perl. But ASP from Microsoft and JSP was the same model. You want to generate pages dynamically on the server. But the framework for creating it was these big object class files, object classes where you had lots of properties you had to instantiate and lots of details you had to do in order to do relatively simple things. It was a complex programming environment for doing complex things. And in particular, you had to do lots of configuration. You had to, before you could do even the simplest thing, you had to specify values for lots and lots of little parts because it was a big framework and you should know what you want for all these things. So that made the process of writing these sort of applications hard because you had to deal with a very large, very large class library, very large API, and you had to call a lot of it in order to do things. The idea of Rails was don't do configuration. Instead, do convention. Which means you don't tell exactly how you do everything. You just do it in a certain way, and since there's a standard way of doing it, the framework figures out the rest. The only time you have to specify a lot of details is if you want non-standard behavior. And the standard behavior is basically what you want. So what this has in practice is by doing things by convention, the code is much smaller and potentially easier to read. So that was, that's really the big thing about Rails, is that it was designed for this convention thing, so making web applications more customizable. Also, Rails, I kind of see as having come along at the right time in the sense of it had good support for Ajax. Which basically just means, and of course, is Ajax is all about JavaScript running on the client, and so this means it gave a good way of talking to that JavaScript on the client from the server. And initially, things like JSP and ASP didn't have good support for that. So you notice I'm not saying that any of these technologies is necessarily, I'm telling about differences in style, not necessarily differences in power or capabilities. And that's because there isn't any. Why are there so many programming languages for the web? It's because they're easy to create. They're not hard to do. And everyone, and basically every application language development environment reflects a certain way of viewing web architecture, a certain way of viewing programming. And by this point in your educational careers, you probably have gotten into a flame war with someone about how to organize a program. Right? Going like, this is the right way to do this. Why don't you put the objects like here and use this? And the other person says, no, you're insane. You're an idiot. Why are you doing it that way? That's how programmers are. And in fact, that's what you should look at when you're looking at all of these things, these different frameworks and stuff. All of them can do the same thing. Some of them will say, oh, this one is more scalable. Oh, this one is faster. Oh, this one allows me to write code. It's all religious. Because the fact is, any of these tools, with the appropriate engineering, you can make it do almost anything. You might say, oh my god, PHP is really slow. You know what Facebook went along and did? They made PHP fast. PHP used to be slow, but now there's all kinds of little tricks and alternative implementations and additions to make PHP really fast, because Facebook needed PHP to be really fast. It was much easier to make PHP fast than it was to rewrite all their code from PHP into another language. And that's the way for most of these things. If you have a real requirement to have some sort of, you know, some sort of properties, you can build it in. But what you will notice in web application things is the technologies that tend to win tend to be open source. And the reason why the open source ones tend to win is because you can have an organization like Facebook come along and say, I'm going to build my entire technology stack on this, and if it turns out I have a problem with this technology, I can mess around with its fundamentals and underneath it in order to make it better. If Facebook had instead decided to standardize on active server pages and they decided it didn't have the right performance it wanted, they would have had to trash their entire code base or have gone to Microsoft and written them a very large check and pray that they would implement something that was better for them. Of course, Microsoft might say, well, why would I want to help Facebook? I might want to make a competitor to Facebook. So open source allows organizations, particularly large organizations, to control their fate. It's just about control. But the quality of the technology, these different things, it's all style. It's about different ways you like to do things. Node.js is a certain style. PHP is a certain style. ASP, JSP, certain style. The current implementations have different technical trade-offs. So if you're doing a particular, choosing a particular technology, today the trade-off will be one way. But in 3 to 5 years, the trade-off could be completely different. You don't know what it is. So, and the fact is, all these programs have to do is produce web pages. And web pages are a standard. So whatever language and environment you use to do it is arbitrary. So I can tell you my opinions about the quality of some of these environments and which ones I personally would prefer to program in. But it's just an opinion. And I will tell you, for this class, the reason I chose Node.js was not because I think JavaScript on the server is the right way to do it. I do think the architecture of Node.js is fascinating. I think the fact that it's JavaScript is very nice from a pedagogical point of view, because that means I can teach one language both server side and client side. And I think in particular the architecture of Node.js is one of the ones you want for making a very high performance scalable web server. But in practice, I wouldn't be surprised if you go out and build something, you're not going to build it in Node.js. Especially if you're working with a legacy code base. But the lessons you'll learn will be applicable to it. And in fact, if you like Node.js a lot, and you want to do Java, there's something called VertX, which is almost the same thing. And I'll stop there.